Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. This week we had a really interesting podcast interview, and I'd encourage you to check it out. We're calling it The Evolution of Evolution, and we had a really nice guest on who actually kind of walked us through a lot of the developments and progress that's been made on the whole subject of evolution from Darwin's time all the way up to now. I don't know, how much people are aware of just how much evolution that subject has had over the years, and I found it kind of interesting, and I was sort of hoping other people might too. So you can check that out. I also posted some thoughts this week, last Thursday, about the Orlando shooting and the nature of how and what we do with the media and the responses to it and the sort of tendency to jump to conclusions about things on that. And I didn't really know when I started writing that video that it was going to go in the direction of talking about gun control. It just kind of, that's where it kind of went. So there's some of that too. So anyway, if you're interested in some controversial views on that matter, then you can check that out too, and I'd encourage you to do so. So let's go ahead and get on with your questions this week. Kay Williams. My questions have to do with your thoughts on the independent Scientology movement. You probably need to know most of my knowledge of this comes from YouTube videos and a few books on the subject, not exactly representative, but all I have available. In many of them, the independent Scientologists seem to be saying that Hubbard's Scientology is valid and that Miscavige has perverted it. Does this mean that they still believe in fair game, no psychologists, disconnecting, SPs, policies on homosexuality, mind control, etc.? Someone said this was just an evolutionary process and that in the future they will change. Has that happened? Why does no one confront them about these questions? Again, I didn't want to betray my ignorance because I can hardly get a good picture from my limited media. Is there any worry that some of the people who enjoyed power might want to recreate it in independent Scientology? Okay, sorry that was an earful. I don't want to sound judgmental about people I don't know, but this kind of thing has historically been frequent. Thanks for your time. The number of people who practice independent Scientology at this point, as far as I can tell, numbers in the hundreds, not even thousands. And of course, some of them might argue with me about that, but from what I've seen of gatherings and conventions and what I see representative independent Scientology groups on the internet, that's what I'm thinking. So we're talking about a very small number of people. Scientology itself is already a very small number of people compared to any other really relevant group or organization in the world. But it just gets all this attention because of its controversial nature and because of the fact that Tom Cruise, John Travolta, etc. are Scientologists. So as far as independent Scientologists go, there's lots of different groups. These groups are small, right? And they deliver Dianetics for Scientology courses in some places. They deliver the counseling services in some places. And, you know, some of these independent Scientologists is just one guy, out of his home. Other ones organize, get into groups, deliver courses and this sort of thing. And I think there's a whole independent Scientology mission that used to be an official Scientology mission in Israel. And apparently they, promote that they're doing wonderfully. And I don't know, maybe they are. Independent Scientology to me is kind of a waste of time, and I don't support it or, really try to push people in that direction unless absolutely necessary. Mainly because, as I've said about, my opinions and attitudes about Scientology is that it's mainly a destructive system. It's meant to be an authoritarian control system. That's when you look at the structure and framework of organized Scientology or the Church of Scientology, that's what it is. You have the ethics trappings and framework. You have the Office of Special Affairs, which is its whole legal division and investigative division and this sort of thing. You have the entirety of the C organization. So independent Scientology often does away with these things or does away with them to one degree or another, right? Because they don't have or even particularly like the C organization. They think, in general, they think Hubbard kind of went off the rails at some point in regards to that. You know, they have disagreements. So what you have is, you know, it's hard to talk about it in general terms because all these individual Scientology, independent Scientology groups cherry pick their own version of what they think the dogma and practice of Scientology should be. So some will hold on to the SP, you know, suppressive person technology and the ethics technology, and they'll use that and they'll push that, or they'll only push part of it, right? And they might not push the suppressive person part, but they might push the other parts of the ethics, the overt and withhold write-ups where you write down all the things you've done that are bad, or the security checking, or what's called the conditions formulas, which are supposed to be steps you can follow in order to improve your life, right? You know, very questionable that those, that any of that stuff actually, you know, has uniform workability, but they think it does, or they apply it in such a way that it, you know, that it does for them, and so, you know, fine. They do, you are right, that, that a common point of agreement between many, many independent Scientologists is that L. Ron Hubbard was right. L. Ron Hubbard nailed it. He figured out amazing, genius, incredible things and discoveries, and despite maybe his personal shortcomings, they still believe that the work that he created is still of value, whether even though they might acknowledge that he was a pathological liar himself, or that there were things that were wrong with him personally, right? Or that he had his own personal shortcomings. But they also believe that David Miscavige is definitely perverted and ruined organized Scientology and has corrupted L. Ron Hubbard's basic intentions and objectives. So that's a common point of agreement. And that point of realizing that you know, Miscavige is really screwing things up, and that Scientology is really not, that organized Scientology is not what it should be, and leaving organized Scientology behind, I mean, that's a good thing. And it does tend to be a step in an evolutionary process of recovery from Scientology overall. And I do know people who, you know, who were involved in independent Scientology or practicing independent Scientology or going out and getting auditing, you know, from independent Scientologists, and then came to the realization that, yeah, no, it's actually bullshit. And no, I don't need to be doing any part of this. And they flush it out of their life entirely. I didn't happen to hit that step. I skipped that and went right to, yeah, get it out of my life. But and a lot of people do, right? You don't have to go through this as a way station on the road to recovery, but many do, and to one form or degree or another. So that's you know, the overview of the practice of it is it's really cherry-picked between various groups. So you'll have a lot of variation in there. As far as somebody taking over, using independent Scientology to sort of take over or gather power or something like that, which was part of your question, there's been talk or fear of something like that, or people maybe, you know, there was a lot of talk when Marty Rathbun first came out and was doing independent Scientology work that he was trying to, you know, create his own Church of Scientology or something in the field, right, under him being the leader. And there were various good reasons to think that that might have been true at the time in terms of some of the things he was saying and the way he was acting and whatnot. But he's changed, and he's definitely not doing anything like that. And I don't know that he ever really wanted to. I mean, there were just indicators that maybe that was the direction he was going in, but then it became clear that wasn't what he was doing. And I haven't particularly heard or seen anybody else doing that. One thing that I will comment on about that is that when people leave Scientology and leave that authoritarian system behind, they do tend to have fairly immediately a recognition that they were under a totalitarian, authoritarian type system. That they were, that it was, that Scientology is a very high control group. And they don't want to be part of something like that again. And they're very gun shy of going anywhere near somebody who might be proposing, you know, or looking like they're trying to run such a system on them, right? So that's a lesson I think a lot of people coming out of Scientology have learned. And so they tend to be, you know, watchful for that kind of nonsense going on. So I haven't particularly seen anything like that. And I think those are all the points of your question. So there you go. J.C. Clements. Nice work on the channel. Having been involved with Scientology for over 30 years myself, I do respect the work you are doing. I am interested in learning critical thinking skills. What's out there that you recommend? There are some great, great resources all over the internet to help learn critical thinking. There are online courses that you can take for, you know, $5 or for free about critical thinking. There's a Critical Thinking Academy website. There's a couple guys who have YouTube channels who focus on critical thinking. So if you go to YouTube and just search for critical thinking, you'll find these resources. There are people who are trying to get critical thinking as part of a standard curriculum in schools at all grade levels. And I'll put some links to some of this stuff in the comments section below. And also, there is a list of some books that I recommend on my website, amongst them being, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most important works I read on the subject was Carl Sagan's A Demon-Haunted World, which was just, you know, amazing, especially the chapter on the baloney detection kit, which is a series of steps I've made videos about. I've talked about it at length. But it's a series of steps that Carl Sagan put together to help people recognize baloney or nonsense that they might encounter in any part of life or living, right? So there are an abundant number of resources. I've posted some videos myself on critical thinking, and you can check those out. I think I put a playlist together on my YouTube channel of my critical thinking videos. So please do check those out too, and tell other people about them. So there you go. John A. Back when I was in the fold in the 1970s, writing to Ron was encouraged. I wrote him a letter or two and received a nice enough response reasonably soon. Do you know if LRH ever wrote or signed off on any of these letters, or did he ever even see any of these letters? I'm guessing no, he did not, but what is your take? Elrin Hubbard wrote a policy letter called Standing Order Number 1. And that policy, or the standing orders, there were a few of them. And the standing order number 1, I don't remember the verbatim, but it was basically all communications sent to me will be seen by me and responded to, right? And Hubbard sort of promised that as a point of policy. He then had a post created, a job created, in every Church of Scientology. There's supposed to be one of these, although often there isn't. And this post or job is called the LRH communicator. And this person was supposed to be working in a church and overseeing that Ron's orders and directives and policies were being complied to. And often these LRH communicators or LRH comms run around doing this. And one of the functions they have is making a box, getting a box made that is called the SO1 line or the SO1 box, and for standing order number 1. And they post a little plaque by a desk where they put writing paper and pens and whatnot. And you can write your letter to Ron and put it in the box. And it's a locked box, and the LRH communicator comes along and opens it and takes the letters out and is supposed to forward them on to Hubbard. Now, at the international level, this is back in the 70s when Hubbard set this up in the 60s and 70s, he had people on the ship whose job it was to answer those letters. And they had either a stamp or they could write Hubbard's signature, so it looked like his, right? And often he never saw anything having to do with these letters. Or I think there might have been periods of time, and I'm not 100% on this. I think there were periods of time where some of the letters might have been forwarded to him and seen by him. Or perhaps if it was thought that the subject matter or the person writing was worthy of, you know, getting Ron's personal attention, then that letter would go to him. But more often than not, the letters were simply answered by the staff who were assigned to answer those letters and then sent on the way, right? And Hubbard also set this line up in the policy. He said that one of the reasons he set this up was not just for PR purposes, but it was also to be able to locate disaffected people, people with trouble areas in Scientology, because, you know, if people were writing to him from Keokuk and saying, oh my God, this you know, this executive director of Keokuk is just ruining the place and the doors are closed, you know, half the time, and I can't seem to get any help and get anybody in here to do Scientology and this sort of thing, then the, you know, Hubbard and the Sea Organization would be alerted to that, and then they could take some kind of action or look into it more closely. So it was sort of a early warning system of trouble that Hubbard set up for that line, right, for that SO1 line. Now, I can tell you that I know somebody, and I won't say her name, but I know somebody who was on the ship back at that time period who told me that her own personal experiences were that these SO1 letters would sometimes collect in stacks and stacks because they just didn't have the time or really sometimes the desire to even get to them because it was just kind of tedious work answering all these, you know, stupid letters to Hubbard. So there were a couple times where they just wholesale took these stacks of letters to Ron and they just threw them overboard. And so they, you know, so they weren't always even answered. So I thought that was a, you know, funny and interesting story. I remember writing him a letter myself when I was about 7 years old or so and getting an answer back, and I thought it was wonderful and all that. But anyway, that line used to exist. And now after Hubbard died, the SO1 line changed over to writing to the Executive Director International, who was Guillaume Lesev, and now, you know, now there is no ED and Executive Director International. But that line, Scientologists still believe that there is a person on post doing that job, and those letters now go to that person. So that's how the line works now. Shire Girl, 2001. Hey Chris, thanks for the great channel. I have a very simple question. Why do Scientologists need their own e-meters? Are they auditing themselves and friends and neighbors at home? I've been wondering about this for a while, as I know selling expensive e-meters to Scientologists is part of the scam. Yeah, it is part of the scam. In fact, selling a ton of Hubbard materials to every single Scientologist is actually part of the scam. It's all the books, all of his recorded lectures, as well as two e-meters. Every single Scientologist is supposed to own two e-meters. And the reason for that is Scientologists are expected to become trained as Scientology counselors or auditors. And when you're in a session, an auditing session or a counseling session, you have your meter and you're using your e-meter to, you know, audit the person that you're auditing, right? But you're supposed to have a backup meter on hand in case something goes wrong with the meter that you're using so that you don't interrupt the session and have to go out and get another meter or just say, oh yeah, if the meter bombs on you, you don't just go, well, sorry, dude, we're going to have to end off now because the meter died. You're not supposed to do anything like that, right? You're supposed to just very calmly get your other meter out and switch them and not even let the guy particularly notice what's going on, right? Or you just take a short little session break and you do it and then you get right back to it. So that's the reasoning or the rationale behind two e-meters. And of course, they charge an outrageous sum of money for all of these things, right? They charge hundreds and hundreds of dollars for these recorded lectures, which they now all have on CDs. They charge, you know, $20 to $40 a pop for each of the books, and there are, you know, like 26 books or something. And then, of course, the meters, which are, you know, just outrageous. So it's all, so these materials and having all of these materials is pushed all the time. And they actually have people whose job it is to sell these materials to the public all the time. They're called bookstore officers. And they have, every church has a bookstore in it where they sell Hubbard's books and lectures and the e-meters. And the bookstore officer is supposed to be busy all the time selling these materials, right? He's not a passive guy where he just sits there and waits for customers to come to him. He's like on the phones calling Scientologists saying, hey, have you completed your L. Ron Hubbard library, right? And they put these sheets of paper grids together of all the materials in a little checkbox, and you can check off that you've got all the materials, right? Every lecture set and every book is on the sheet. And they even have in the mid-2000s, they put together what was called a materials guide chart, where they chronologically, they made a huge, big poster size layout of a chronological sequence of all of Hubbard's lectures and books. And they told Scientologists straight up, they said, look, we've released all of it. It's all out there, right? And so what we want you to do is start at the beginning and just go through all of this. And there's thousands of lectures. And Scientologists are expected to listen to all of them and read all of the books and do this all in this chronological sequence. So this is I'm talking about all this because I want you to know that this is a major part of the Scientology operation. This is not a sideline for them. This is mainline. They sell a ton of these materials to existing Scientologists. And of course, every time these things are re-released and updated or corrected or whatever, then they have to buy the newest versions, right? And they have to trash the old ones. And this has happened at least four times that they've gone through these cycles of revising all of the materials and saying, this time we've got exactly what L. Ron Hubbard expected. This is exactly what he said and how he wanted it. I mean, they started this back in 1987 is when they started re-releasing this stuff, at least when I was around. And they in 1991, and then again in 2000, and then again lately. I mean, it's just, you know, as much as they can. So this is a major, major part of the operation, and that's why I wanted to talk about all of that. Jeffrey B., artist for Echo. I've been reading your book, and one of the questions I've been wondering about is why the Church of Scientology keeps the location of Gold Base, Int Management, secret from its members. Not that the Church of Scientology does the logical thing much, but it seems unnecessary to me. It would be like the Catholic Church trying to keep the location of the Vatican secret. Why bother? Well, it goes back to the history of how the international base was founded and set up, because this was all done back in the late 1970s is when this location was first found out in, I think it was first it was La Quinta, and then they moved to Hemet, where they bought the golf course property, which is where their INT base is located. Now, when all that was going down, Hubbard was in hiding, and I mean real hiding, because Operation Snow White had gotten busted, the FBI had raided Scientology, Mary Sue had, you know, and these other Scientologists were being indicted, and Hubbard was very, very seriously hiding. So he was in, so the location where Hubbard was, was called like Location X or something. It was like this, you know, this very, very confidential place, and so the international base where the films and international management and all that was set up was also supposed to be confidential because they didn't want Scientologists just wandering up there and bugging them or doing anything like that. And they wanted the world at large to be leaving them alone at that level, right? They wanted to just get on with what they were doing, and they didn't want any possibility that Hubbard could be connected to, you see. There were a couple of people who were with Hubbard, Pat and Annie Broker, and they cared for him, and you know they were his care providers and that sort of thing. But Pat Broker would meet with David Miscavige, who worked at the international base. And so if people knew where the international base was, the idea was then they could potentially, you know, follow David Miscavige or follow whoever it was who was delivering communications to L. Ron Hubbard. So they wanted a couple layers of secrecy and transparency, or not transparency, but secrecy from, you know, protecting Hubbard. Now, after Hubbard died, well, the base location was confidential, and they just kept it that way out of security considerations, right? Because this is the place, I mean, if you put yourself in David Miscavige's shoes, and you look at the things that he was up to and what was going on, he went from being a mid-level management type person to having taken over Scientology. And he wanted to run things his way, and he didn't want everybody prying and looking into, and he certainly didn't want any public coming around who wanted, you know, who would get tours of the base or something like that. He wanted this to be his domain, right? And he wanted security to be kept tight on this. So they maintained the confidentiality of the location. And it's about a 2-hour drive or something from Los Angeles, so it's close enough to the rest of management and operations and this and the Los Angeles service organizations and stuff that the guys from the base could go check things out and then go back to the base or whatever. You know, it wasn't prohibitive that they be able to be in touch with, you know, the non-confidential locations of Scientology, but they wanted that place to be you know, basically be left alone. And that's continued all the way to now, right? Although, of course, like the other secrets of Scientology, the only people they're really keeping it secret from are the Scientologists who don't look on the internet, because everybody else, you know, can literally GPS Google where Scientology International headquarters is, right? So that led them to putting up the gates and, you know, saying that there's only, you know, that public tours will occur, but, you know, only at their discretion, and putting signage on the road and that sort of thing. Used to be much more hush-hush, right? But they've kind of acknowledged that, yeah, the world kind of knows where they're located. So it's not really super, it's not as confidential as it used to be because of the exposure all over the internet. And I think they kind of know that at this point. It's time for Flash Answers. Leo Taxel. I used to work in sales for cars and for various energy companies. A common thread was that we used a program called Salesforce. It measured basic statistics about sales, size of commission, etc. The way you describe Scientology, cold calling, and other techniques basically sound like your run-of-the-mill sales organization. Did you or others ever use that program? Or did you guys just keep track of all your own stats without computer software? We had our own, you know, just take a pen and write it down kind of statistic tracking systems. And we also had internal Scientology-made statistic programs. So we didn't use Salesforce, but there were programs that were done for the call-in and sales people, where which was programmed internally by Scientology computer programmers who work in the C organization. And they put those systems together for computerized management of sales and calls and cold calling and all that, because you're absolutely right. Scientology is got a major part of its operation is the sales operations. Dave in Chicago. Do you think Tom Cruise will ever wake up and leave the church? Nope. I don't. I honestly don't. I think the guy is gone 1,000 feet deep in the lake of Kool-Aid, and I don't think he's ever going to come up for air. Navik Darkroom, what are your thoughts on fad diets? I don't like fad diets. I think it's all part of the woo and nonsense that gets scattered around in the world of pseudoscience. Because, you know, this, if you look at the history of dieting and nutrition and this sort of thing, I mean, it changes every few years. And that's fine. I mean, there are new discoveries. Science changes things every few years. So I'm not, that alone is not an indicator of pseudoscience. And there are discoveries and things that are known about bodies as far as what's good and what's bad for them. But, you know, I can sit here and rattle off, you know, 5 major changes in dietary recommendations since I was a kid as to, you know, what used to be very, very good for me is now very, very bad for me. And what used to be very, very bad for me is, yeah, maybe it's not so bad after all, or, oh yeah, actually, no, that's really good for you. And this just goes round and round, and that's not science, that's just speculation, opinion, and opportunism, where people are just sort of peddling some, you know, gimmick or pill or, you know, or product that they're being paid to push, which I think is Dr. Oz's number one way of making income. So I don't have a lot of good things to say about, you know, guys like that. So those are my short thoughts on that. Juliana Cohen. My mother just mentioned to me that Scientologists can't do scents and said that John Travolta requires any hotel room be free of scent for 24 hours. Is this just a specific celebrity being weird, or is there LRH policy on this? No, there is LRH policy on this. He specifically, Hubbard was a fanatic about not having scented products or laundry soap being scented or anything like that with his own clothing and whatnot. He didn't want any of that anywhere near him. He claimed to have a hypersensitivity to smells and whatnot, And so he was just deaf on that sort of thing, to the point where Sea Org members who worked for him had to wash and rinse his shirts like 7 times before he would, you know, before he would wear them, because he didn't want any scent of any kind, right? And so this he wrote down into policy, re-fragrances or something, I think is what it's called. And he's just all down on any kind of scented products. And so as a result, in Scientology, and especially in the Sea Organization, no scented shampoos, soaps, conditioners, none of that stuff, right? Even organic smells, they just don't like it. They don't want to have it around. And so I've literally been in a room in the Sea Org where I was sitting there doing my work, and some executive walked in, went, "Who's got the scented shampoo?" And everybody was like, and, you know, you, right? And you, go handle that right now. And they literally just kick him right out. Guy had to go wash his hair or something, so they didn't have scented, you know, fragrance in his hair because he was using scented shampoo. I mean, they're fanatical about this. So, yeah, it's not just John Travolta being weird, although it is John Travolta being weird, but it is a Scientology thing. Okay, and so we've come to the end of another episode, and thank you very much for your questions and comments and feedback. Please continue putting them in the comment section below. I hope that my answers were helpful to you, and that if you like what I'm doing on this channel, you'll consider throwing me some love and support with the through my Patreon campaign or through the donate button. So thanks for coming around. Leave your questions or comments below, and I will see you guys next week.